As America celebrated its 241st Independence Day, North Korea asserted its own will and launched yet another missile test. This missile is said to have the capability of reaching Alaska, though as yet without a nuclear warhead. North Korea's latest move comes within a week of President Trump telling the world that the era of U.S. strategic patience with North Korea is over. But what exactly does that mean in practical terms, and what options are left? Brad Gosserman is executive director of the Pacific Forum CSIS in Honolulu, an independent program of the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joins us now by phone. Hi there, Brad.
Hi, Beth Ann. Good to be back. Happy day after the 4th of July.
You too, and good to talk to you. Now, we heard earlier this year President Trump saying that, you know, the North Korea's test of an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of reaching the U.S. just won't happen. We heard him say earlier in this week that, our patience has ended with North Korea. What exactly is left to him, despite all of this rhetoric, despite what the Security Council has tried to do?
Well, that's actually a very good question. Everyone says that North Korea is the land of bad options, and that's been the case for a number of years, and it continues to be the case today. I think, however, it's really important that we make sure that we understand accurately the nature of the North Korean threat, that we don't exaggerate it, and that we don't perhaps paint a more dire picture than the bad one that actually exists.
What is the one that exists that you see?
Well, the North has proceeded to develop its nuclear and its missile capabilities, and the test that it conducted yesterday is, by all accounts, a significant step forward insofar as it appears to have, and most of the analysts concede, it actually is an intercontinental missile, or a missile that has the range to reach the United States. But that doesn't mean we're under threat yet. The North Koreans have not yet, one, demonstrated that they have the capacity to miniaturize a warhead to put on that missile, and secondly, and most importantly, they haven't demonstrated the ability to put that warhead or that payload, whatever it is, exactly where they want it to go. So that suggests that it's still premature for us to be hyperventilating it. I think in some cases we need to be very careful that we don't hype the threat in ways that either unnerve our allies, that unnerve the public and prompt a rash reaction, or worse, perhaps spark North Korea or prompt them to think that maybe they have more power and influence than they otherwise do.
Well, they certainly were sending a message by doing this on the day that America was celebrating Independence Day. Isn't that sort of a thumb at the nose to America?
I think we like to think of it that way, but I think we also tend to go too far in our inclinations to see everything that North Korea or any other country does as in relation to the United States. North Korea is, in many ways, testing according to a schedule driven by its own technological needs. In other words, these are tests that need to be conducted, and it was going to conduct them, hold them, regardless of the 4th of July. I would say it's just as likely that this is a way of repudiating the summit that President Trump held with his ROK counterpart Moon Jae-in last week, and it's a way of signaling to the G20, which will meet later this week in Hamburg, that North Korea is not about to be overshadowed, and its fate it will be determined by decisions made in Pyongyang, not in Hamburg or elsewhere.
I'm glad that you brought up the G20. You also mentioned a little earlier in our conversation about not escalating or hyping this to the point where it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. What do you think the stance of the U.S. should be as the G20 meets?
Well, certainly the U.S. position needs to be firm, which it is, although, quite frankly, I've been struck by a president who, his tweet yesterday was actually somewhat silly in the sense that doesn't Kim Jong-un have something else better to do with his time, and maybe South Korea and maybe Japan and maybe China will take care of this. That doesn't strike me as much of a policy, and recall this was a man, too, who was convinced back when he first began discussing this and throughout the campaign that he knew and he had all the answers to these problems. So I think what we have to do is keep the pressure on. We need to make sure that the international community is united in the message it sends to North Korea, and we and our allies and partners in other countries that have a similar stake in restraining North Korean behavior are all doing their very best to ensure that North Korea is restrained. So we need to be picking up the sanctions. We need to be tightening the screws. We need to be sending messages to the North both that continued ill will and ill behavior is a threat to itself, and, however, we also need to make it clear that North Korea behaves well, that good things are possible. And that's one part of the equation that we've actually, I think, neglected in much of our discussions and conversations.
In the collaboration that you'd like to see with other countries around the world, what help do you think that would be realistic to expect from China and from Russia now?
Well, you know, China, we've long insisted and believed that the Chinese hold the key, and they don't. The Chinese can hurt North Koreans, but they certainly can't force outcomes on Pyongyang. So one of the things that China has to do is, of course, make it more difficult for Chinese companies or North Korean companies that are increasingly working in China or working with other Chinese companies find it difficult to actually conduct business. So we need to impress upon the Chinese, but more importantly, the Chinese need to understand that it's in their best interest to tighten those screws. And that's a very tough sell. Russia is a little equally difficult insofar as Russia has its own geostrategic interests, and to some degree, having North Korea continue to be a bit of a problem, not too much of a problem, but a little bit of a problem, serves Moscow's own interests as well. But Moscow doesn't have quite the levers, I think, that Beijing has in Pyongyang. But still, again, to expect either of them either to want to or be able to solve this problem on their own or even working in tandem is asking far, far too much.
Where does this leave the UN and the Security Council? You know, they've already tried with all of this. They're being seen as being ineffectual. How, if there is a way for them to come back into this with more gravitas, can they?
No. Quite frankly, all the UN can do is legitimate the actions of individual nation states. And that's, frankly, that's a UN problem in addressing any international issue. But all that the UN can do is continue to condemn these behaviors, ensure that other countries do not have an excuse for not joining the international consensus to censure North Korea and to impose sanctions, and just try to marshal, if you will, individual states to act more forcefully.
As all of this is continuing, there's also the issue of whether Americans should be going to North Korea. I mean, you can still pull up lots of sites which are advertising all kinds of trips there, and yet we've just seen what has happened in the last month or so with Otto Warmbier dying. What do you think Americans should really think about as they potentially consider going to North Korea? Or should we simply say that Americans should not be going to North Korea, period?
Well, I would say that it is a very dangerous bet to go to North Korea. You can go in with your eyes open, acknowledging all the potential risks and all the potential dangers. The problem is that the behavior that North Korea is prepared to consider offensive still goes far, far beyond what many Americans or anyone else would consider offensive. So you take very real risks. I think we have to believe that we'd like to think our tourists and our citizens are intelligent enough to calculate that on their own. So the reason for denying or forbidding Americans from traveling to North Korea would be more as a way of denying them, the North Korean government, the revenues and the funds that would come from supporting those tourists. And frankly, they're pretty expensive trips. But the danger here is that North Korea is desperately seeking leverage to engage the United States on a number of issues. And unfortunately, American citizens in their country seem to be bait. And the North Koreans have a very, very low tolerance for insult and a ready willingness to grab whatever assets it can to use them to extort or otherwise get a U.S. attention.
Given the fact that a lot of Americans may not necessarily be in that same thought space and understand that, even if they think that they've schooled themselves enough, should then the government take more steps to keep some of these companies from being able to go to North Korea?
Well, the argument would be, again, along the lines of the first rationale I explained, which is what you would be doing is preventing North Korea from acquiring the hard funds and the cash to support the government. So that would be the argument would be, of course, that we need to tighten the sanctions and extend their reach. The problem with that invariably is that if we have no forms of communication or no contact, I think there are two other issues one would raise with that. One is the fact one could make the case that some sort of exposure is probably good for creating cracks in the social system, and that maybe by meeting outsiders, North Koreans can understand better the precarious situation that they're in. The second one, too, is just that it's difficult to you then risk by just impacting ordinary citizens in North Korea, the ones that are running tour companies, et cetera, that they're going to be further damaged. Their economic interests and their earnings will be hurt, and that instead of targeting the elites that are the real bad guys, if you will, that you're actually affecting negatively the ordinary citizens of the country.
And Brad, very quickly before we go, How likely are further sanctions, and specifically targeted toward what?
I would say, number one, there's absolutely a better chance of further sanctions. Certainly the United Nations will push some, but they will always be targeted. That's the best that some of the holdouts, for example, Beijing and Moscow, are going to agree to, that they will demand that the sanctions be focused on individuals that somehow or other are helping North Korea advance its nuclear and missile program, so that we can identify, the U.S. intelligence services and others, South Koreans, can identify companies that are specifically working on those projects, then they would be the targets of sanctions.
As always, I wish we had more time. When you're back in Honolulu, we'll sit down and have a longer conversation. Happy travels, and we'll see you when you get back.
Thanks. Always good talking to you.
You too. Brad Glosserman is the executive director of the Pacific Forum CSIS in Honolulu. It's an independent program of the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. The Pacific Forum has provided policy-oriented analysis and promoted dialogue on regional security, political, economic, and environmental issues in the Asia-Pacific region since 1975.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, organic farming as the career of the future. But first, your quiz.
For today's backyard quiz, we're taking you with us on an adventure needing sturdy walking shoes and a flashlight. The place is Hawaii Island and one of the highlights on Crater Rim Drive. We enter a large, dark opening that doesn't appear to be man-made. Looking down, the floor of the mouth of the cave looks like flat rock. To keep heads from scraping the ceiling, it's best to stay in the center of the path and keep walking. Flashlight beams reveal beautiful shapes in the walls. Further in, it's completely dark. The air is moist and the ground has become uneven. Glimmering in the walls, specks seem to be glowing. We're now some 50 yards inside this dark part of our backyard. So, where are we? And should we turn around or trek on? For extra credit, can you tell us what awaits us if we continue? The answers are coming up in the second half of the show. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know them. And today's prize could be yours if you're first and right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Learn more about new product and training updates for Hawaii schools at achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
A generation or two ago, forward-looking young entrepreneurs were not as likely to list farming as a career goal. It promised a life of hard work with too few rewards. The hard work remains, but the most recent generation to emerge into the world of work has a different view, and young men and women are building lives on the land, embracing organic farming and all the values that go with it. It's a trend that Pam Boyer, who runs farmers markets around Oahu, has seen it firsthand, and she's with us in our studio. Hi, Pam.
Aloha, Chris.
You meet a lot of young organic farmers, and for them, it's really a way of life, isn't it?
It's a lifestyle, and it's also a passion that they have. They love being on the land. They love growing things, and they love coming to market or however they're going to sell that product and share it with the people.
This is a pretty work-intensive life that they've embraced, isn't it?
It is, but when you're passionate about something, it doesn't seem like it's work.
Is that what they tell you?
Yes, they are. They are so alive when they talk about farming. You can see the light in their eyes.
Do they describe the path that got them there?
You know, everyone has a different story.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them were musicians like Paul Isaac, and he just changed his diet and he wanted to grow the food that he's eating right now. And he's an incredible farmer.
Mm-hmm.
Another one got land and he just wanted to start growing for educational purposes. So everyone has a different reason why they're farming.
Well, you know, no matter what the reason, it's a pretty growing trend that you see.
What I'm seeing right now with the help of Hawaii Farmers Union United on all the islands, there's a new group of young farmers ages 25 to 45 that are embracing sustainable farm practices and growing real food for local people to eat. And it's such an exciting time. And there are a lot of programs, Go Farm and the FAM program on Maui, that are supporting young people that want to learn how to farm and giving them the techniques to be able to do that.
Yeah, that was the next question that came to mind, is where do they learn this stuff?
Yeah, the new thing now are farm apprentice programs,
mm-hmm.
where people are mentoring these farmers to learn how to run a business, because farming is a business. If you don't make money at it, you're not going to be able to stay in business.
Sure.
How to grow things if you have problems with the land, how to balance the soil, and all the different things, the marketing part of it. So it's an exciting time right now in Hawaii.
In a way, to do that, you have to sort of leapfrog backwards to older farming practices rather than modern mechanized chemical-intensive practices, don't you?
I think we had the best of both worlds right now. I think we have the organic farming methods, but now we have new technology where if something's wrong, you can go on your phone and you can put in the problem, and right then and there, you'll have the solution. So I think organic farmers at this point are so far ahead of the game when I started many, many years ago.
It was a pretty rare vocation, say, 30 years ago, wasn't it?
Well, I'm from California originally, so I grew up with a lot of organic farmers, but I think there's been a lull for the last 20 years, and now it's resurfacing, and farming is becoming very sexy.
What do you think has brought that about?
Well, in Hawaii, we don't know how many days we really have worth of food, but I think people, you know, really see that it's important that we grow our own food. And these young kids, they've just found something in putting their hands in the soil and creating food. They become ecstatic when they're doing this.
Some of them must, drop out at some point, I would think, because you couldn't entirely be prepared for how much of a commitment this life is. I would think in the case of some people anyway.
I think the biggest problem why they're dropping out is because they can't get land. There's one farmer I know of in particular. He's married with a child. They're young. And he's a great farmer, and he's trying to find land. And he's either going to go to the Big Island or he's going to go to the mainland. And this is what the kind of work that Annie and I do, is that we would like to help these farmers get on the land so that we don't lose them here on Oahu.
Because
the population is here, and this is really where we need. I'm selfish. I want the food grown here.
Sure. But of course, as in any other area, housing, for example, on Oahu, we're constantly reminded that there's only so much of it. Lots of competition for every parcel, I would think.
Yeah, farming is competing with development, but there's also, I just want to mention and throw this in, if you can call the governor about the little houses on farms, it's so important that farmers live on the land. I'm not talking about gentleman farming. I'm talking about real farmers, because there's a big problem with theft. And if something goes wrong with an animal, the farmers need to be on that land. So that bill right now that Cindy Evans pushed through is on the governor's desk, and we don't want him to veto it. It's very important for farming's future that we get these little houses on the farms.
What's the bill say?
It basically allows, I don't know how big they are. I think they're 300 square feet,
mm-hmm.
A house where people could actually live on a farm. And I think they're movable, too, so it's not like a fixed structure.
But the bill does what?
It allows these farms, it allows people to live on the farms, mm-hmm. which a lot of times you're not allowed to do.
Really?
Yeah. And it's a problem because theft is huge.
Is that something you hear a lot from the organic farmers that you deal with?
About theft?
Well, just, yeah, and the need for these
oh, absolutely.
Little houses.
Absolutely, yes.
So in the absence of a little house, how do organic farmers, how do they make it?
Well, they
just
either
live close by
and they hope, you know, my friends this was about 2 years ago, had 23 pregnant sheep stolen off their farm because they didn't live there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the sheep were duct taped and, I mean, it was horrendous. And then I know at Sitar they had some kalo ready and over 1,000 pounds were stolen right before they were going to harvest it. So these kind of things could be prevented if somebody was on the land.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where all this ends up, Pam.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Okay, thank you.
Pam Boyer is the Director of Development of Farm Lovers Farmers Markets, which sponsors markets in Haleiwa, Kaka'ako, Pearl Ridge, and Kailua. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Jamarek, Honolulu's premier African dance band, comes to HPR's Atherton Studio on July 15th. Experience the rich, living musical traditions of African percussion and vocals. For tickets to Jamarek, call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Hawaii Senators Brian Schatz and Mazie Hirono are increasingly taking to social media to make their own tweet points over immigration, the travel ban, and health care. And they are getting media attention. Civil Beat political and opinion editor Chad Blair has today's reality check. Hey, Chad.
Hello, Beth Ann.
So here we are with a president who has a preference for tweeting about policy and comments about the media.
We sure do.
He's taken a lot of heat for doing that. Now we've got this growing trend to tweet from Hawaii senators. Is this a case of if you can't beat them, join them?
Well, I think, first of all, Senator Schatz and Senator Hirono have been on Twitter for quite some time, as well as Facebook presence. And, of course, they have a typical communications team sending out press releases, and they appear on TV.
Yeah, but not
but
like
something,
lately.
Something really picked up since President Trump got into office. And in particular, it's those two issues that you mentioned, immigration and health. Remember that Senator Hirono, I believe she still is currently the only immigrant in the U.S. Senate. She was born in Japan. And then with Senator Schatz, his late father, a medical doctor. So not only have they been tweeting out a great deal critical of the administration on these policy issues, they're getting picked up. For example, Senator Schatz recently was on the Stephen Colbert show, not the senator himself, but his tweet about what the Congressional Budget Office had to say about the Senate's health care plan, the one that's being discussed right now. I can't use the exact word that was in the exchange, but it's worth going to. And by the way, Colbert and Schatz got into a Twitter back and forth where they acknowledged each other. And then Hirono, when it comes to the travel ban, as you know, the Supreme Court recently allowed it to partially go through until they review it in October. She called three of the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, the three horsemen of the apocalypse, and said that the fourth one is on its way. I'm presuming that's the president himself. I don't know. So not only is it the frequency, but it's the tone, the absolute passion that's behind their positions.
Well, I mean, that's just the point, that the tenor of those tweets has changed dramatically. And, you know, and some would say, you know, is this playing the president's game?
And right now, the president, there's actually a poll that says he actually went too far, if you can imagine that, with what he had to say about the Morning Joe host, Mika Brzezinski, about the facelift. And a new poll says you just went over the line. You shouldn't have gone that far. But I think shots in Hirono, as well as many other in Washington, and that includes Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard and Colleen Hanabusa. It hasn't been nearly as active recently, but they're realizing that this can be an effective way to communicate with a heck of a lot of people and to fight back.
And that seems to be, you know, the bottom line for many who have been taking to both, you know, Twitter and many other platforms, that if this is where people are, this is where you have to go.
Right. And of course, it's an extra poignant element regarding the Senator Hirono, who, as we know, just had her second cancer surgery. I'm told she is recovering back in D.C., but she's still being active. I spoke to her staff just the other day, and she's watching the news and hasn't put her Twitter handle down just yet. So they're getting the word out. And I think that speaks well for Hawaii. As you know, we've really made a lot of news in terms of our challenging the immigration ban, Attorney General Doug Chin, the governor's AG. So I think that's nice to see our senators fighting strongly for issues that they feel is important to Hawaii. Remember, we got great health care here, and we are definitely a state of immigrants.
Right on both counts. And we'll talk more about it as it continues to develop. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair. Six months into the Trump administration, the U.S. Supreme Court actions continue to be front and center. Possibly the court's biggest decision, its full opinion over the Trump travel ban, is yet to come. That will directly involve Hawaii, as one of the cases came from here. We probably think a lot about how this decision will affect immigration, but there's another important question: how the court's decision will affect public approval of the law, especially if the justices uphold the travel ban. More generally, how do Supreme Court decisions affect public opinion? In a recent study, two legal scholars tried to answer that question. Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us now with what they found. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Bethann.
So whose study is this?
Well, it's a study of a professor at Berkeley and a law professor and a political scientist, Katharina Linos and Kimberly Twist. They published this in the Journal of Legal Studies.
And this just came out within the last week or so.
Came out fairly recently, right. And what they were interested in is particularly under what circumstances does a Supreme Court opinion on a controversial case that upholds the law increase people's approval of the law. So it's one part of the question of how does law change public opinion. And they find out, yeah, it does under certain circumstances.
What are those circumstances?
Well, the circumstances are kind of interesting. The Supreme Court, most people don't know very much about what the Supreme Court or what it does, even less than they know about Congress and the presidency. They're more likely to rely on other people, and they're more likely to rely on the media. So not surprisingly, one of the things that makes a key difference is how the media reports the case. And what they say is that if the media reports the case in a positive frame only. And by that, they don't mean necessarily approving of the decision, but only emphasizing the majority opinion, then it's more likely to make people approve the law. If they do a mixed thing, some stuff on the dissent, some stuff on the thing, then it's less likely, and almost nobody reports one-sided negative.
I hear you giving a qualified yes to the fact that this does, in fact, impact public opinion. How then are they judging whether or not a news agency is really mixed, and how that has some impact on the same people who might be watching that news agency?
Well, the way that they find this out really is is they do it in a couple of ways. One way is actually through some experiments using hypothetical media. But the more important way is that they do an analysis of how the media covers court decisions. And one of the main things they find out is that generally, and here they're interested mainly in two decisions. One is the very controversial Obama health care decision that said that the option was constitutional, was legal. The other one was an immigration decision that upheld the state of Arizona's right to ask people to show their papers. Okay, so what happens is that when they looked at how the media, lots of media, reported this case, whether they emphasized one side versus the other in terms of the amount, they call it a frame. And so they discovered how much the media reports only the majority opinion, which means that you're getting basically one side normally. But that's the side that's most likely to change people's minds about whether the law is okay or not.
So come October, let's say we see a Supreme Court that says okay for the travel ban as such, and obviously that would be a big loss for Hawaii. What do you think the impact is in a state like ours?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question that should start like this. How much in today's political environment are all bets off? That is, in a more normal political environment, let's say that this study, what this study found would be the deciding factor. That is that the decision, even if it's controversial, is more likely to be brought to people's attention by emphasizing only the majority opinion. Now, if this is not normal, the media is not normal, the Trump administration is not normal, and Hawaii in this case is not normal because part of the case is going to come from here. It's going to really be, and we're more salient. So the real question to me is going to be two questions, really. One of which is, how does our media, the Star Advertiser, Civil Beat, the television stations, how will they report this? Will they report it in a kind of common way, which is to emphasize one side? And then you're more likely to see maybe approval of the law, even if it goes against Hawaii. Or is this going to be different because times are different, the media is getting attacked more in a counterattack, and because this involves Hawaii directly? So there's no way to know, but it's interesting to think about this kind of stuff in light of the very different political environment.
And forgive me for asking you to prognosticate a little bit, but because you have had a very long history with Hawaii and the fact that we are as we are as a state, bluer than blue, shades of blue, how do you expect this to come out in terms of how we will report that, should it in fact happen that the Supreme Court says travel ban's okay?
So that long history crack is about me being old, right?
That's no, not at all.
Oh, okay. Just wanted to check. I think that it's less likely if the Supreme Court rules that the Trump administration ban is legal, I think Hawaii is less likely to change its mind about where we stand on this. Now, it's kind of interesting because we know more about what the attorney general thinks and what the politicians think.
And certainly we'll hear more from the AG.
Yeah, we will, and we don't know. But I think here the media is less likely, not just because they tend to be a little bit left of center maybe, but more likely because of the particular Hawaii interest. If the court rules what's against Hawaii, I think you're still more likely to get a mixed coverage, a coverage where there'll be a lot of stuff about the dissent because the dissent is going to talk about things in favor of our petition. If that's the case, and the fact that we're sort of a democratic state for sure, then it's less likely. I think the court is less likely to change people's minds here to be in favor of the ban.
In general, though, with this research, have they looked at this as being a really big deal, that the findings from the survey would indicate that the Supreme Court has a great deal, or their decisions have a great deal to do with how the American public accepts them or rejects them?
Well, you know what? They think it does. I don't think it does. And here's the difference. They're jumping from saying that this changes people's mind under these circumstances to say that this says a lot about a broader debate within the scholarship on the impact of the Supreme Court. There's a lot of scholarship. The dominant findings about the impact of the Supreme Court in the last 20 or 30 years is that it doesn't have that – opinions don't have that much effect on public opinion. They don't change things that much. These people say – that's not that this may show that that's not necessarily the case. I think it's still more likely to accept the notion that Supreme Court opinions can be very controversial, but that the only way that they bring about change is depends upon the rest of the political environment and what the other institutions do to them.
Given all of that and the fact that this is one study, how then would you like to see this move into a different arena to be able to test some of this in the way that you've just talked about in terms of how we would see this bringing about social change?
Well, there's two ways, and I don't want to get too inside political science-y baseball here, right? But one way is simply to expand the study to see if it holds up for a lot of other things. But I think a more important thing is that we have to, and we, I think, particularly includes legal scholars who kind of lean to the left, have to take a closer look as intellectuals and communicate to the public how the nature of courts have changed in the past, and the behavior of courts, federal courts especially, have changed in the past 40 years. I grew up during a time, and I learned this stuff during the time when the Supreme Court was looked at the kind of center, the advance guard for making changes, for constitutional changes, social activism. Courts have not moved away from that to quite an extent. The Supreme Court is more conservative. The federal courts are more conservative. And people who used to bring legal issues to the federal courts now think more about not doing it and go to the states. So I think we need to kind of rethink to see where we stand now with courts.
Meanwhile, we're going to put up this survey, and everybody can have a look at it for themselves. Thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
Always good to talk to you. Neil Milner taught political science at UH Manoa for 40 years and is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View.
Aloha, I'm Ed Ebisui. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In the first part of our show, we began an adventure on the island of Hawaii along Volcanoes National Park's Crater Rim Drive. We started in a massive cave. The solid rock floor slowly became uneven, and we discovered beautiful shapes and colors embedded in the walls. The deeper we ventured, the darker it became, and we had to decide to either turn around or keep going. The shiny twinkles we saw embedded in the walls were mineral deposits that formed into crusts or small crystals. And the light at the end of the tunnel, a beautiful tropical rainforest. For those of you who have trekked Nahuku, also known as the Thurston Lava Tube, you're one of the fortunate ones to see firsthand the lava tube discovered in 1913 by local newspaper publisher Lauren Thurston. As of last Friday, according to the National Park Service website, the electrical system is being worked on, so interior lighting in the lava tube is off and temporary battery-operated lights are being used. Flashlights and our headlamps are required to enter. Please check at the Kilauea Visitor Center information desk for the most up-to-date information.
And we were asking the question a little earlier in the show about where exactly we were, and as you've just heard Chris tell you that, Bernice Akamine knew that too, called us from Volcano, and is today's winner. Thanks so much for playing the backyard quiz with us. If you have a question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and we just might use it for a future show.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from Achieve 3000, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Learn more about new product and training updates for Hawaii schools at Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
A 150 years ago, when Hawaii was a sovereign kingdom, Queen Emma founded a school, St. Andrew's Priory, to give girls an equal chance at a high-quality education. It's a mission that continues to this day, and its new head of school works to balance tradition with a contemporary educational focus. She's Dr. Ruth Fletcher, and she's with us in our studio. Thanks for coming in.
Aloha, Chris. Thanks for having me.
What are the arguments in favor of girls-only education? In fact, let me start by saying, what were the arguments in favor of it 150 years ago?
150 years ago, it was really important to have a Queen Emma as our founder.
Yeah.
Because most of the young women that were living in Hawaii at that time were educated by either the Ali'i school or the missionaries' children by the mission schools. Mm-hmm. And the average everyday young girl was not educated and did not have an opportunity to be educated. So Queen Emma saw that as a need and then opened the doors of St. Andrew's Priory and gave girls an education that they deserve.
Well, you know, sadly, 150 years ago, most people felt that women didn't really need that much of an education, you know, teach them how to read and function somewhat, but not, you know, certainly not getting into the advanced sciences or anything like that.
Yes, surprisingly, that was so. And I thank Queen Emma for her foresight. She understood that young women and young men both could contribute to society and also had a lot to offer. And when she did open the girls' school, it was really to make sure that they could have a life that they could then fulfill their own dreams and also contribute back to society as a whole. She was a very forward-thinking, progressive thinker, and she helped found not only our school but Queen's Hospital, and she brought St. Andrew's Cathedral here to the islands.
Yeah.
So she was really kind of the Renaissance queen, the people's queen, a lot of care that she brought to our state. And mm-hmm. Our children that graduate from St. Andrew's Priory are her living legacy.
Well, it'd be nice to say that 150 years along that we had achieved complete gender equity in jobs and salaries and things like that. We're not quite there, are we?
No, we're not. And I wish we were.
What do the girls at Priory today think about that?
They probably don't like it. They are very much interested in equality for men and women. What I notice is that when you have a single gender education, what the girls do with each other is they have limitless opportunities because they have to take all of the roles that exist in the school, so they become leaders, sometimes followers, sometimes. However, they explore their interests and their passions, and then they know who they are so that they can be strong. And I think that when a girl graduates from St. Andrew's Priory, there is some piece of her that knows perseverance and dedication will be necessary because sometimes the world won't see them for their capacities, for mm-hmm. what they can actually do. However, if they are good enough and they are strong enough, they will succeed.
You certainly, in the biographies of various role models that young women might look to, they would find stories of a great many stories of women who had encountered obstacles based solely on their gender, wouldn't they?
Yes. I think we do need to have role models that are female, and I think Queen Emma is one of the models that we use so that our young girls can look to a female queen that was so amazingly great for the state and mm-hmm. for the children of Hawaii and the people of Hawaii, that they know that if we want to carry that legacy forward, then we need to fulfill our own greatest capacities so that we are using everything that we have in our minds, our hearts, and our souls so that we better the world.
I seem to remember, and this is not a particularly accurate memory, but I seem to remember studies of co-education mm-hmm. that determined that in a co-ed environment that maybe boys would be more likely to be called on. Is there some truth to that?
Yes, there's some research that does show that oftentimes in a co-ed classroom, boys are called on more frequently than girls. We also know that girls and boys develop differently, and so the curriculum should be suited more towards who's in the classroom. So in the early years, K to 5 and the K-1-2 grades, girls are actually more mature than boys and can sit longer and be more focused in a longer way, whereas boys really do, in general, need to be up and about and moving. And so if you ask them to do the same things, it's actually not appropriate. So we try to make sure that we educate girls and boys in a way that they can best learn. And so we have a single gender boys school, K to 5, and then our K to 12 girls school.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a product of a co-ed education myself. However, what I have always played in sports, which are single gender,
mm-hmm.
girls sports. And what I noticed is that you do have to play a leader role, a leadership role, and you have to also collaborate and cooperate with each other and deeply respect other people's strengths and talents. And what I love about St. Andrews and our female all-single gender education program is that the girls strive to the highest is our motto. So they strive to the highest themselves, but they also recognize that another person is also striving to their highest. And so there's a deep respect for human beings, and that you can be great and I can be great too.
Do you think girls have a different attitude toward competition than boys at the approximate same age?
That's a good question. I am from a family of six, and I have three brothers and two sisters, and some of the girls were more competitive and some of the boys were less competitive. So I think the competitive drive, it depends on what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you want to be the best at something and you really love it, you're going to be competitive.
is it appropriate to approach education with that same sort of competitive spirit that you might bring to sports?
I think it depends. I think there's some times for competition and some times for collaboration. In our world today, I think collaboration has a high value because we have more and more people in the world. And it's really important that we understand what other people are thinking and then work together to accomplish something. And it's not as much about the individual as how it is about the collective. So competition is good, but working in a team is as good.
Do you think the drive to collaborate is perhaps stronger in young women than young men?
I think that the way a woman's mind works is often more networked and more interweaving,
mm-hmm.
and not as linear sometimes in general. This is a gross generalization.
Well, sure, yeah.
But oftentimes getting from point A to point B in a straight line is done more easily by a male than it is by a female. A female might see all possibilities and meander a little.
So a lot of powerful arguments in favor of, single gender education, I
yes.
would think.
I think the biggest argument for single gender education is that you understand who you are and how you fit into society in a way that gives you strength.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a single all-girl classroom, you look around and all your models are women and they're all taking on all of the options. They're doing all the technology. They're doing the science experiment. They're leading speech and debate. And
mm-hmm.
all the models that you see are women. So you see yourself as being capable and strong. And I think that's very important for any person.
Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you.
Dr. Ruth Fletcher is in her first year as head of St. Andrew's Schools, which today encompasses three schools, the Priory, Queen Emma Preschool, and the Prep.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
There's always a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host, Derek Malama, joins us at this point in our show every day for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, we have, for example, the opportunity to learn a Japanese martial art
Yeah, you can try it out tomorrow on Maui. It's the art of Aikido, and you can try a 4-week introductory course given by Maui Ki Aikido. And this is the oldest dojo in the U.S. for Aikido. Uh-huh. It was established in 1953, and it's on Maui. And you can learn the history and principles of Aikido. I took Aikido when I was a child.
Uh-huh.
Chris. It's about turning your opponent's energy against him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it's and they also talk about meditation and all that.
Did you get a lot out of it when you studied it as a kid?
Yes, but unfortunately I forgot everything later on in life. But
that's what growing old is all about. Yeah. And there's a Jazz Vespers in downtown Honolulu tomorrow.
Right, and this takes place at St. Peter's Episcopal Church. Features musicians, and you know them, Reggie Padilla, Star Kalihiki, Dan Del Negro, and John Hawes. And they call it jazz in a contemplative style. You explained it before, but could you give a short, brief thing on that?
Well, these are all terrific musicians, and you know, it's I suppose a meditative kind of jazz, perhaps, would be a way to describe it.
So it's all about meditation then.
A little
tomorrow
bit, yeah.
With the jazz and the Aikido.
Uh-huh.
This Jazz Vespers is every Thursday at 6 p.m. at St. Peter's on Queen Emma Street.
And then there's another jazz event this Friday.
Hawaii State Art Museum presents the 6th annual First Friday Star-Studded Evening of Jazz with a bunch of stars, including Janai, again, Star Kalihiki, Amber Ricci, Mike Lewis and Friends, and more. The evening will be at the Hawaii State Art Museum this Friday from 6 to 9 p.m.
That's a terrific event. I've been to that a number of years. Thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that are going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that's going to bring us to the top of the hour. We hope you'll plan to join us for the conversation on Friday. Meanwhile, repeated cyber attacks continue to disrupt governments, corporations, and individuals. Tomorrow on Town Square, we'll talk about cybersecurity.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Comments can be posted on Facebook at The Conversation. Our Twitter messages at HI Conversation are BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear the show again or any other shows, take a look at the Conversation page on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Join me tomorrow for Town Square.